It's really interesting to come back here. For those of you who don't understand some frame of reference, what it means to have been here 40-some years ago, we started a freshman class with Bob Rome and Lynn Brock, Frank Genesta. These are my classmates. Ed Spencer had only been teaching about 20 years then. it was a great time. You know, it causes you to stop and think about what was chapel like then. It wasn't like this at all. I wish I could take you back. I mean, it was an Alfred Auditorium, so you could still catch some of the ambiance. But it was a very different experience. I was saying, what chapel stuck out in my mind after 40 years? What chapel service do I remember best? It was a missionary speaker. This missionary speaker was coming, and he was passionate about the mission field that he was on. And he said one of the great benefits of being a missionary was that he had the delight and pleasure of learning a new culture. Having said that, he stepped behind the curtain in Alfred Auditorium, disappeared. A moment later, he came out in a grass skirt, bare-chested, 5-foot blowgun, poison darts. A cultural experience. He walked around the side of the auditorium, went around to the back of the auditorium, and now he's shouting as he goes because there's no microphone. Every head in the auditorium is turned around backwards, looking at the back of the auditorium, where he's standing back there waving the blowgun. He puts a dart in the blowgun, calls up to the stage, the curtains part, and two guys are standing there holding a bed sheet with a red circle on it. You had this moment when you knew exactly what was coming, right? So he puts that thing up to his mouth, every eye in the place right on him, and he gives a mighty puff into this thing. Simultaneously, there's a scream in the third row. This poison dart had never made it to the stage and was buried in the back of the second row seats, having passed harmlessly between shoulders of two students. That was the cultural moment I remember. It was almost its own religious experience for me. I said right then, I made a vow. I said, if ever, I am invited to speak in chapel at Cedarville, I will not A, wear a grass skirt. B, I will not demonstrate primitive weaponry. Today I'm here to make good on that commitment. Now, I too can say that my life and ministry has been one of experiencing a new and wonderful culture. I have always been a technologist as a hobby and an interest, although my degree is in history. So that gives hope to you history students that this can be another life. There are no blowguns or poison darts in my cultural journey, but there is the digital world. And it too is its own culture. This prior Saturday, I was in St. Louis addressing an audience of 150 Bible college and seminary professors from about 50 schools. They had come together to learn more about how to integrate Logos Bible software into their schools and curriculum. The audience consisted of people aged 40 to 65. You see the culture thing coming here? So I started off by giving a quiz. I said, show by raising your hand if you have ever owned a record player. Every hand. Every hand in the room. Have you ever owned a 45 RPM record? Every hand. A 33 and a third? How many of you have ever threaded a movie projector? How many of you have ever run a reel-to-reel tape recorder or listened to an 8-track tape? How many of you have ever used a pager? How many of you have owned a black and white TV? How many of you remember Kodak film? It was like the hands were glued to the sky. They never came down. I said to them, if you answered yes to these things, you are pre-digital. You have lived through the digital revolution in contrast to the students you teach. Your students miss the revolution. They grew up in it. The students walking into class today don't know anything about a revolution. It's simply life. They played with digital toys as children. They entered college more comfortable with the internet than reference books. They have more hours logged on a computer than hours reading books. They have more hours logged watching TV and computer programs than they have ever spent in a library. Interestingly enough, however, they have an unusual, abundant knowledge of research. They know more about research than any previous generation, but unfortunately, most of their research experience has dealt with unvetted data off the internet, where nonsense and sense get equal billing. I said to these faculty members, classrooms, in a sense, are like time machines. In today's classroom, you may have your only real opportunity to experience medieval living. Students come into a classroom and they see methods which have held true for 1,000 years. They use books which have been used for 1,000 years. Students often coming into school, I should talk to Lynn Brock about this, but my experience has been that students coming into schools don't have the library skills they used to. They don't even know how to find the library without a GPS in many cases. Having arrived safely with their GPS, they don't know exactly what they came for. Because indeed, it is a different age. Now, this is the world we live in at Logos Research Systems, Logos Bible Software. We work with one foot in the old book culture, and we work with one foot in the new digital culture. Our goal is to represent traditional, unabridged reference works with an internet type environment. Now, here's how this came to be. Before there was an internet, before there were DVDs, PDAs, portable cell phones, MP3s, Microsoft Windows, or Power Macs, in the early days of microcomputers, I was a computer distributor in the early days. The reason I got into computer distribution was I just loved computers. They were my hobby. I had them all. I had the TRS-80, I had the Apple, I had the Commodore. I just played with computers, and these silly little computers just didn't have as much power as my watch. But they were addictive. So my older son, Bob, growing up in this house, he liked to play with the same toys. So he would play with all the computers I had around. Only he was really, really adept to computers. And he started playing with the business machines that I had for demonstration purposes. It got to the point where I could hardly go out on a sales call because he had the computer. And he kept taking the latest and greatest computer and working on it. And he started writing software when he was 12 and 13 years old. He taught himself the C programming language when he was 12. When he was 15, he had started his own software company and was selling his software on national magazines. He earned enough to buy a car before he was old enough to drive. I used to say, you have a better customer list than I do. He sold to the Navy, to the Army. He sold to Fortune 500 companies. He sold to GE Aerospace. They didn't have any idea they were dealing with a teenager out of his bedroom. I mean, I thought about national security at one point. At school, Bob's counselor said, Bob, we don't think you should go back for your senior year of high school. You will probably just spend it in study hall. We think you should seek early admission to university. Well, he wasn't old enough to drive at the time, so he went to Drexel University in Philadelphia because we lived in South Jersey, and he was able to get a train into the city to go to Drexel. So Bob heads off to Drexel, and while he was 16, Microsoft interviewed him, being familiar with the software which he sold in the national publications. They offered him an internship in Seattle, which is a long way from New Jersey. And he couldn't take it because they had a requirement that interns had to be able to drive cars. So after another year at Drexel, Bob accepted the internship, and basically our son left home at 16 and went 3,000 miles away, which was a traumatic time for us. It was a great time for him. He thought he had gone to Candyland. So Bob went back and forth to Drexel on internships and Microsoft, and finally Microsoft offered him a full-time position. One of those dream things was stock and everything else at the tender age of 17. At the age of 19, he was the youngest program manager in Microsoft. At Microsoft, Bob linked up with another Christian named Kiernan Reiniger, and the two of them decided that they wanted to write some Bible software in their spare time. Microsoft had a very interesting policy at the time. They said, we encourage you, because everybody here is young and single in those days, and everybody is like living here. You could go into Microsoft in the middle of the night and there'd be people just hanging out and writing code as if it was a fun thing. So I visited him a couple times, and it was just an amazing thing. I walked through the halls of Microsoft at 3 a.m., got hit by a soccer ball. So Microsoft had this policy that encouraged you to develop your own ideas and your own programs, and you signed a formal agreement saying Microsoft had the first right to purchase whatever you developed in your off hours. So a lot of Microsoft products got born by people pursuing their own ideas after hours, and Microsoft gave them full use of equipment, test labs, everything else. So Lagos was written at Microsoft by Bob and Kiernan. And it was interesting that when the product was finished, they took it to Steve Ballmer at Microsoft and said, well, the agreement says we have to show it to you. And he says, it looks very religious to me. He says, I don't think Bill Gates is interested in religion. And he signed a waiver saying that Microsoft didn't care anymore or have any further interest in it. About the same time, Bob had developed the software, and it was based on the King James Bible, because the King James Bible is in the public domain. And of course, everyone who saw the software said, give me the NIV, give me the more popular Bible. So Bob had asked me to call Zondervan on his behalf. I called Zondervan, who controls the NIV, and I said, can we license the NIV? And they said, yes, absolutely, no problem. That will be $10,000 deposit and $10 per copy with a minimum of $1,000 per year. Where would you like the contract sent? I said, wow, that's a pretty steep hobby. So Bob and I discussed that, and that was kind of a wet towel on the whole project. So Bob calls me up a couple days later. He says, I'm prepared to give up my career at Microsoft. Let's form a company and go into the Bible software business. I think it's more useful than working for Microsoft. So it was that time in my life where the company I had been working for, AEG Olympia, the old German typewriter company, Olympia Typewriters, probably nobody even remembers a typewriter, let alone Olympia. I had been brought in to convert their 1,200 dealers to computers before typewriters became obsolete. Well, typewriters became obsolete faster than I could convert dealers, and the division ended up closing down. I was on the street with severance. For the first time in my life, I'm unemployed, and Bob's on the phone saying, let's form a new company. And that's how Lagos was born. So the company was formed around Christmas of 1991, and we officially opened our doors the first day after New Year's in 1992. We raised some money from some friends. We had a staff of 5-6 people, and we started selling to Christian bookstores. Now, in the beginning, Lagos was an alternative to a printed Bible. It was an electronic Bible that allowed you to look up words very quickly, but it was essentially a Bible on a computer. Who were our customers? Our customers were what we called fondly pastor geeks. They were pastors who really liked computers. If you didn't like computer in those days, you didn't want to buy software, because these things weren't real dependable then. So you didn't buy them to increase your productivity. You bought them because you really liked them. Later on, as computers became more powerful and able, our audience moved from the geek market to the Bible student market. And as soon as we moved into the Bible student market, we came to the realization that when people study the Bible, they don't do it in isolation. They use commentaries, they use dictionaries, they use cross-references. And the demand came at us for more books. So our first goal was to replicate a bookshelf full of books that you might typically use for Bible study. We did that. And then from there, we went to a bookcase. And then we said, maybe, well, let's try to aim for doing a wall full of books. And then we said, you know, we had so much positive feedback from missionaries who said, I can take these books across any border in the world. And I don't have to pay for them every time I move in shipping cost. This is really a good deal for us. So we continue to make larger and larger collections. And where we are today, we're actually in brick and mortar replacement today. Today, we can replace a library building with virtually everything that would be in, say, a small Bible college library. We can put on a 3-pound notebook computer. Well, we can certainly put a lot more on than that. The way technology is going now, within 5 years, we'd be able to put the Library of Congress on a 3-pound notebook computer. Technology is moving so fast. The Bible, by nature, is a multilingual book. It's been translated into more languages than any other book. It itself comes from ancient documents, in particular Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek, plus all the cognate languages that surround those languages, all contribute to the development of the Bible. We said if we're going to be in the Bible software business, we have to have a goal. Our goal is this. If the Bible is the inspired word of God, it's written in Greek and Hebrew and Aramaic, we want people to get to close to that, as close to that original resource as within their capability. So for the scholars, we want to work in Greek and Hebrew and Aramaic. For the lay people, we want to say, what tools can we develop which will take you to the Greek, the Hebrew, and the Aramaic without having to go through the pain of mastering those fields? See, you know, when I left seminary, I'd say within 24 months, my knowledge of Hebrew was about equal to a lake trout. You just can't keep this stuff in your head if you're not living in it. So I said, I'm the example. Help me to use original languages. Help me to get closer to the source. I mean, it seems every generation will remove further from the source documents. We keep getting looser and looser translations, but lots of them, so that we get further and further from the original text. The purpose of the software is to get us back to the source material, to get closer to the fire. And that's what drives us. A brief snapshot of Lagos today. Today we have 9,000 books and Bibles in the system. We work in 30 different languages. We produce 2,000 new titles per year. We work with copyright materials from more than 100 different publishers. And we've gone into the publishing field ourselves. The new trend is digital first, print second. Why? Because with computers, we can do exhaustive treatments of subjects that you cannot do in print because of the limitations of print page count. Most publishers will not print a 30,000 page commentary. And yet, there are scholars who have 30,000 pages of research to share. So the trend now is to do the original work in digital form, abridge it, and take it to a print publisher. We have approximately 80 projects running right now with scholars around the world that will go to digital first and print second. As far as we know, right now, we have more reference works for biblical studies underway than any print publisher in the world. In addition to this, another aspect of Lagos is producing products for other agencies who want to have digital products but do not have programming capability. So we produce products for the German Bible Society, the Bible Society of Japan. You would love this product. The Bible Society of Japan has done a Greek Bible karaoke. There's a little bouncing ball that runs across the top of the Greek text and reads it out loud. We did that for them. Soon it will be available to you. We do the electronic products for InterVarsity Press, for Thomas Nelson, for Concordia, for Augsburg Fortress. We do the electronic products for the Army and Air Force chaplains. Our software is registered to students in 500 schools. We have now approximately 300,000 users around the world. We employ 160 people in North America, and we contract with 200 additional employees outside of the U.S. Why am I giving you these numbers? Mainly because I'm recruiting. When Jesus taught us to pray, "Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven," we're taught to extol God's name, to advance his kingdom, to be obedient to his will. This we do by bringing people closer to the fire, by exposing them to the text. That's what we use our time and our talents and our energies for. We would like you to consider sometime the possibility of joining us. We use linguists, graphic artists, marketers, salespeople, editors, accountants. We have a broad range of opportunities in a kind of work ministry that you might not have considered in the past. I close with a great quotation. "Religious truth is imprisoned in a small number of manuscript books, which confine instead of spread the public treasure. Let us break that seal which seals up holy things and give wings to truth, in order that she may win every soul that comes into the world by her word, no longer written at great expense by hands easily palsied, but multiplied like the wind by an untiring machine." That was written by Johann Gutenberg in 1455.